From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. As of today, it has been 1,158 days since Governor J.B. Pritzker declared a public health emergency in Illinois at the outset of the COVID-19 pandemic.
In every step that we take, our priority is getting ahead and staying ahead in our response, and doing so with the safety of our most vulnerable residents at the core of our preparedness.
More than 3 years on, today marks the end of an era. Pritzker announced in January that the public health emergency would end today, at the same time as the national public health emergency that's also coming to an end. But the pandemic is still ongoing, according to the CDC. Dozens of Illinoisans are still dying from COVID every week, and thousands are still getting infected. Many more are reckoning with the effects of long COVID on their lives. And put that together, the end of the emergencies will mean drastic changes in not only how we track COVID, but also how we respond to it. So joining us now to help talk through all of this is Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, Professor and Chief of Infectious Diseases at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine. She's also Medical Advisor at the Sangamon County Department of Public Health. Dr. Sundaresan, welcome back to The 21st Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
We also have a reporter with us. Jonah Meadows is the North Shore editor for Patch. Jonah, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Brian.
Good day.
And from the Illinois Department of Public Health, we are joined by Graham Briggs. He is the new Illinois State Epidemiologist. Graham, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for the opportunity. Glad to be here.
So I want to begin with each of you, and maybe Dr. Sundaresan, I'll start with you. At what point, thinking back 3 years, at what point did you realize that the disease that would come to be known as COVID-19 was going to be more than just a brief news story, that this was going to be something that really changed our lives?
Yeah, so, January, we heard about the disease. I still remember vividly. We were rounding in infectious diseases, and the ED said, we may have somebody with COVID, and it's coronavirus. Oh, it's just a cold virus. And that's really what the first few discussions were. And then by the time end of January, February, it started to sink in. This is not just a cold virus. This is really very serious. And I remember in Springfield, March 14th was the day we had our first patient in the ICU who unfortunately did not make it. And there was a press conference, and that time it was real. The disease and implication, everything was real.
Absolutely. And that was right around the time that the governor issued a stay-at-home order for schools. Graham Briggs, what about you? What was your first encounter with this? When did you know it was going to be serious?
Well, I think there's a sort of building momentum that we saw in early 2020. You know, we do see new types of viruses emerge with some routine and keep an eye on that. And so those of us working in this field, you know, saw that there's a new coronavirus that looked like it was emerging in China. And so that was something, you know, that perks our interest a little bit and something we were watching. It's really when we started seeing it really cause a devastation in Wuhan province in particular that I personally started getting concerned about where this is going to go. As we saw COVID start moving out of China and into places like Italy, you know, that was another step in the momentum and the progress that told us in public health that we better get ready. This is potentially going to be something severe and could be a pandemic starting here. And then I think for me personally, that first case in the U.S. was one that at the time I was a local public health director in Minnesota, and we pulled together our emergency response people on the day that first case was identified in the United States and started looking at if this were to progress through the United States, how would we respond and what would we do? And so I remember that first case that we had locally as well, and how quickly it went from planning to pandemic response, and the rest is a blur really for the next 2 years.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Yes, I remember I was a State House reporter at the time, and there was a hearing, a Senate hearing, I believe, where the state's public health director at the time said, you know, go about your lives. We're not telling you to do anything, different yet. And that was maybe a week before the stay-at-home orders came down. Mm-hmm. So things changed very rapidly, at least for those of us not working in public health. Jonah Meadows, what about you? What's your memory of this?
My first awareness of it, I think, came in January or February when a friend of mine, her parents were unable to come visit from China, and it became clear that there was something very serious going on over there. And even though it was more of an international news story at that time, it piqued my interest and sort of made me think that if this escapes China, it's going to be it's going to be a major story for everybody. And then in the first Illinois case, I remember the press conference with Dr. Arwadi, the public health director in Chicago. And it was soon after that a real flurry of each individual school district having to come up with their own strategy for how they were going to when they were going to shut down or if they were going to shut down before the state, and sort of constantly updating every single story on all of the towns that we cover, because each city, each sort of local public body was having to deal with it on their own before there was really a playbook coming from the state, before there was before the stay-at-home order. And then it was March 9th disaster declaration that sort of began centralizing the state response. And then we're sort of covering that every day for the next, seems like 2 years, but I think it was more like 9 months of daily press briefings from the state.
Felt like the longest 9 years of our lives. Let me take a moment to remind listeners, this is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about the end of the COVID-19 emergency orders, which is happening today, both from state government here in Illinois, as well as at the federal government level. We're talking about this with Graham Briggs, who's the state epidemiologist at the Illinois Department of Public Health, Jonah Meadows, who's the North Shore editor for the news site Patch, and Dr. Vithya Sundaresan, professor and chief of infectious diseases at the SIU School of Medicine based in Springfield. Dr. Sundaresan, broadly speaking, then, where are we today with the COVID-19 pandemic? Are we at a point of stability?
It's good that we can actually be without masks. And feel safe to be without masks in the hospitals, too. Masking is optional now for healthcare workers. So we're definitely at a much safer point. Vaccinations, the availability to test, and also treatment that's available has made it possible. Almost 91% reduction in hospitalizations and 95% reduction in deaths. With these resources that we have are huge. So I think we're definitely at a much better point right now. We're not in an emergency. So, yes, the public health emergency comes to an end, but the vigilance continues. Some of the lessons we have learned, surveillance, not to the extent that we've had, but, we need to continue to have that surveillance in some form or the other, genomic surveillance, wastewater surveillance, all that continues. So, yes, I think we are definitely at a safe point right now with the end of the public health emergency, but we still make this a public health priority if things were to take a turn, especially with the fall months.
Jonah, what is the reasoning you've heard from state and federal officials on ending these disaster declarations? Why now?
The European equivalent of the CDC ended their public health emergency. They switched to what they call endemic management more than a year ago, last April. The World Health Organization, they ended the global health emergency, which started before our state one. That ended last week, I think, last Friday. And so, I mean, I think sort of aligning the U.S. with the rest of the world maybe is part of it, but we have our own very different healthcare system than the rest of the world. So it has a lot of moving parts, and there are a lot of overlapping public health emergency declarations, not just the state and federal, but there's multiple different federal ones. And as we roll back all of these layers of emergency rules, we need to come up with new rules. There's a lot of different schedules. So not everything is switching on and off today with the end of this declaration. I mean, it doesn't end the pandemic. It just ends this emergency declaration. And so it changes the kind of emergency powers, for instance, that the governors had in order to, you know, do dozens of executive orders that I think none of them have been checked by the legislatures, but some of them have been challenged in court, and then he's changed them or modified them while they've been reviewed by judges. So I haven't heard anybody say, well, we need to end this emergency for one specific reason, but given the patchwork of emergency spending that we're doing, emergency rule changes that we're doing, I think it makes sense from, I guess, a bureaucratic or a legislative point of view to get to a system where we've incorporated the public health response to the coronavirus endemic or pandemic into our regular normal set of rules and laws, and don't have to have a bunch of overlapping sets of emergency rules to deal with something that is, you know, practically not an emergency.
Certainly. And I've certainly heard Republicans arguing that the General Assembly should have been more involved in this process from a much earlier time in the pandemic. Let's talk about some of the practical things that are changing, though. And Graham Briggs, I want to ask you, as the state epidemiologist, with this ending of the emergency declaration, what's going to change in how we're tracking COVID-19? Or have, you know, maybe the question is, what changes have already been put in place?
Right. I think to the last question, that's a good place to start here, is what shows us that we're in a pandemic is really the strain on the hospital system, the high rate of hospitalization, the deaths, and all of that we've been monitoring over the last couple of years is what really shows us in public health that we're in the middle of a pandemic. And as Dr. Sundaresan mentioned, seeing, you know, 95% decrease in hospitalizations and deaths is what shows us that we're moving out of the pandemic. And so that doesn't mean that COVID's gone. It's going to be around. We've seen throughout the pandemic now that this virus is likely to become endemic. And so there are still people that are going to get this and get sick. We are still seeing deaths. And so we would expect continuing activity, but we're not seeing the strain on the system like we did during the peak of the pandemic. And we're not seeing the deaths like we did before. And so that allows us then to really shift when we're looking at the entire population of Illinois to looking for change rather than trying to capture every piece of data to try to respond to outbreaks going on all over the state at all times. And so by focusing on change, we can do things like monitor wastewater to look for changes in new variants popping up, like this BB116 strain, or, you know, be looking for changes in severity in the people that are getting hospitalized, you know, if we're seeing a higher rate of them need ventilators, or, you know, those sorts of things allow us to continue monitoring the situation in case there's a change, which there could be. We don't expect that, but it allows us to continue to monitor what's going on with COVID in the community around the state, and then if necessary, respond to smaller clusters or outbreaks and things like that. You'll see some of the information that's been on the state website go away. We won't spend as much time tracking and doing data analysis on things like that. And what that really turns into is we're seeing COVID turn into a situation like other infectious diseases like salmonella or influenza that we can monitor, you know, be able to see risks or concerns in the community as change happens, and and work on intervention at those levels to stop those outbreaks and reduce risk in the community. That is a very different thing than trying to respond to a pandemic where our emergency rooms are overflowing and there's, you know, literally in Illinois, I think it's been over 35,000 people that have died related to COVID since the pandemic began. And
anybody hear me? I'm just checking.
Yep. We're still on air. So you know what? This is actually a good opportunity to take a break here. We are going to continue our conversation on COVID-19. Sorry, I had a little overlap there with our next guest. But if you want to join us today, call in at 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. What questions do you have about the end of the emergency declarations in the COVID-19 pandemic? 800-222-9455. More to come here on the 21st Show after a short break. Stay with us.
The 21st is made possible in part by Busey. Whether you're just starting out or upgrading to your dream home, Busey can guide you every step of the way, because they know there's no place like home. Busey, fulfilling dreams since 1868.
This is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about the end of Illinois and the nation's emergency public health orders that are taking, I should say, they're expiring today. This is related to the COVID-19 pandemic. We're talking about this with Graham Briggs, who is the Illinois state epidemiologist, been in the job about a month. Dr. Vithya Sundaresan is professor and chief of infectious diseases at the Southern Illinois University School of Medicine, also an advisor to the Sangamon County Department of Public Health, and Jonah Meadows, who is the North Shore editor for the news site Patch. And if you want to join our conversation, if you have a question about what is and is not changing today, 800-222-9455 is the number to join us. That's 800-222-9455. So, Jonah, let's talk about access to care that people have and how much it might cost, especially for people without insurance. What is going to change with regard to all that?
Well, one big thing that's going to change is the amount of people who are on Medicaid. States are going to go through and, for the first time in 3 years, reduce the amount of people on Medicaid. And that could be anywhere from 400,000 to 700,000 people in Illinois. What Medicaid covers is also going to change, and what private insurance covers is also going to change. People could start paying out of pocket for instant COVID tests if they don't have Medicare or Medicaid, depending on their insurance. If you're prescribed PCR tests, you probably will still have them covered by your insurance, although depending on your plan, you could see a copay. The hospital reimbursement is going to change. That doesn't affect healthcare consumers or patients as much, but hospitals are going to not get as much money back from Medicare. And the sort of Paxlovid and the other other drugs that people are prescribed, they could start paying for those too, depending on their insurance. But for people on Medicare and Medicaid, a lot of the coverage is going to continue through next September because of these emergency rules are being not rolled back all at once.
Interesting. And I keep getting notices from my pharmacy. Hey, last chance if you want to get reimbursed for tests through your insurance. I don't know if they're trying to clear their inventory or just, do a service or what. But that is something else that seems to be changing as well. We have a caller on the line. Dave is calling from Urbana on line 4. Dave, thanks for calling in.
Yeah. Hi, everybody. I got a question for you. And, you didn't hear of a lot of people that were well-known or family members of the well-known that died from COVID. And I wonder if they had access to the few ECMO machines they were a little more scarce. But it's just funny how nobody, not that I was looking for people that I knew that died, but, you know, musicians, athletes, actors, wealthy people, the percentage of, you just didn't hear of any of those people dying. And I wonder if it was the ECMO machine that they were, the few we had, that they were put on them, and the public really wasn't aware of that.
Interesting. I don't know if Dr. Sundaration, if you want to weigh in on that. I am thinking back, like Colin Powell was a notable person who died from complications related to COVID. But I don't know if you have a perspective. You know, COVID was referred to as the great equalizer early on. Maybe that changed as, you know, people struggled to get access to certain devices.
Absolutely. You know, the amount, the number of ventilators that were available in the ICUs was being tracked. In fact, that was one of the important surveillance mechanisms, too, to see what the burden has been on the hospitals. So number of hospitalizations, ICU beds availability, the ventilator availability. ECMO is not readily available in all settings, especially in smaller hospitals. ECMO is, you have to have specialized staff to really monitor that and run that as well. So, you know, a lot of times people needed to be transferred, and we don't have as many ECMO machines as we do ventilators. So that's even lesser in comparison to the number of ventilators. So definitely, I think location made a big difference. And then also how sick somebody was. Not everybody is eligible to get on ECMO. So I think in terms of the severity of illness, and if they're getting better with the ventilator and some of the other medications that were available at that time, then not everybody needed ECMO too.
Interesting. All right. Thank you. Thank you for the call, Dave. We appreciate it. Dr. Sundaration, we did also, you know, we've talked before about this feeling of fatigue a lot of people have felt as this pandemic has gone on. And I wonder if we're seeing that continue to be a factor here with, you know, for example, the uptake of vaccines, the bivalent COVID booster. I understand it's been available for a while now, but I understand that far fewer people are taking advantage of that. I mean, how do you balance that attitude around the pandemic with the need to continue messaging people to be aware that this is something that is still something they should maybe keep in mind in the back while they're going about their lives?
Absolutely. You know, the how the vaccine has really helped us, we have enough data now, and especially with COVID vaccines, the I think it's probably one of the largest pool where worldwide we have data on how the vaccine has helped in terms of keeping people out of the hospital and preventing deaths. Yes, in terms of, you know, the conversations we have with our patients, I think a 30% rule is something that helps us understand how we want to have those conversations with our patients. 30% of our patients are always wanting to know more about vaccines and are wanting to take the vaccines when they're available. 30% are usually on the fence. They want to know more about whether it's useful for them or not, and individualized based on their needs. And we spend a lot of time talking to them, giving information regarding, you know, benefits and how it would be useful for them. And then 30% do not really want to take the vaccine. So, you know, in those situations, we do still give the information. But you know, like you were talking about the fatigue setting in, there is definitely that fatigue that we see in our practices. Somehow, what has been surprising is in the public health department, there are a lot of people coming in for COVID and other vaccines. So, you know, even the other primary vaccines or vaccines for adults, which are recommended, all that took a hit to the 1 or 2 years in the beginning of the pandemic. So 2020, 2021, we that suffered as well. So there's a good catch up with those that's happening as well.
Graham Briggs, as we're looking ahead, what sort of data should people be looking at to try and get a sense of where the pandemic is, if they do want to follow it. You mentioned that the state is not going to be crunching as many numbers as it did. I don't know if the sort of weekly news releases that the people in the media like me get every week are going to cease. I don't know how much those are getting out to the public anyway. I can tell you as somebody in the news industry that those stories are not as well read as they once were. But how can people stay abreast of if there is a local spike that they should be aware of?
I can tell you the thing that I'll be watching most closely is emergency department visits around the state. As we move out of the pandemic and move into more routine pan-respiratory surveillance or watching for flu season and to see if we're seeing spikes of COVID and things like that, we do have the ability to monitor who's going through emergency departments and what sort of illness they've got. And that gives us some clue as to what's going on with respiratory illness in the community. In addition to that, I want to be looking at hospitalizations, and that really gets to severity of disease. So a lot of people going into the emergency room because they've got a cold or the flu or COVID and getting sent home, or are we seeing a change in the pattern with people actually going to the emergency room and then being sick enough that they need to be admitted into the hospital. And as a public health professional, being able to understand what's driving that, if it is a strain of influenza or COVID spiking in a community, helps to give us that information that then we can share with the community and share with our partners on the clinical side as far as what we see going through the community to help with treatment decisions and things like that that they'll be making. So that sort of information will still be available, and it's kind of part of that paring down now to looking at the really important stuff like we do with all infectious diseases to really look for strains on the community or what we call morbidity or mortality, sickness and death in the community related to these infectious diseases, COVID being one of them.
Dr. Sundaresan, there are a lot of people out there for whom the pandemic is still very much a concern, maybe somebody who's immunocompromised, somebody who might be undergoing treatment for cancer, for example. What would be your message to them as we enter this yet another new phase in the pandemic?
With an increased risk greater than 65 years and then immunocompromised individuals do run a risk of having COVID, which can be moderate or severe. So there is an additional booster, which has now been recommended from CDC. So that is highly recommended for people at increased risk. That's very helpful. And then, continued masking. This has been discussed in groups of infectious diseases experts as well. Areas where, clinic areas which are for patients with immunocompromised patients, do we continue masking in those areas? And it's an individual choice. Masks do definitely protect, even from respiratory viruses, other respiratory viruses. We saw that during COVID when our flu numbers were really low as well. So continuing to mask and, those personal choices to wash hands and just continue the infection prevention practices, I think those are some of the things we can do. Test, if symptomatic, test early. And then there's treatment available. Paxlovid is very effective. So seek out for these treatments as well. So those are some of the recommendations.
I want to share a text message we got from a listener, and I did mention it at the beginning of our conversation. There are still people out there who are dealing with the effects of long COVID, and Karen in Champaign told us, we have two friends suffering from long COVID. They're both young. Their partners and families are taking up the slack where they can with cooking and caring for the person, but relationships with the children are suffering. Financially, they are suffering, and they have no foreseeable end to the lack of energy and health concerns. Yes, they were fully vaccinated and both had mild cases of COVID. Dr. Sundaresan, where are we? What resources are there for people like the friends that Karen mentioned?
There is actually a lot of work now being done in patients with long COVID. One in five people with COVID run the risk of having symptoms which can persist. In fact, develop new symptoms even after the initial bout of COVID. or worsening of symptoms that they had. So all these are possibilities, brain fog, fatigue, and it's a myriad of symptoms. In fact, CDC had listed at one point about 300 symptoms, 30 of which they put now on the list of long COVID. And there are resources available in Illinois, and this is a multidisciplinary approach to patients that have long COVID, and with support groups and support from our colleagues from behavioral health as well, mental health as well, for anxiety and other emotions that you know our patients can come up with feeling all these symptoms that can be lingering. So we do have a lot of resources. SIU has a long COVID clinic, and we have a lot of patients that we actually help with making referrals to our colleagues if it's cardiology related or physical medicine and rehab medicine, if it's energy or muscle related. Pacing themselves and, just energy conservation is something that we focus on with support groups. And then we have our behavioral and mental health colleagues that help out with counseling when needed.
Graham Briggs, I guess we're coming to the end of our time together. How is Illinois going to remain prepared for possible future waves or another pandemic? I mean, there is this fatigue we've talked about. I think a lot of people were stunned at the sort of public, how this became a political issue. Maybe in retrospect, we shouldn't have been. But how is Illinois thinking about that for the next pandemic, be it in a year or 100 years?
Right. Well, we've got a surveillance system set up. You know, that's something that we do in public health, watching for changes in infectious diseases and things like that. So hopefully we should have a system so that if we were to see local surges or something change with COVID, we'd be able to detect that and ramp back up. But you raise a great question that is an ongoing question, I think, in the field of public health right now or across the country, is to how do we look at funding going forward and how do we look at preparedness and being ready for that next pandemic? Because it's not a matter of if we have one, we will have another pandemic. On average, this happens about once every 100 years throughout history. And so really utilizing this experience as a learning opportunity in addition to everything else that we went through with the pandemic, so that we can get better at how we respond to pandemics and how we see them evolving, coming out of animal populations and things like that, and how we saw the response work in the United States, and really taking some of those lessons and working those into how we're planning for that next pandemic. And while we all hope it doesn't happen in any of our lifetimes, part of my job is really to make sure that we are prepared if we get another pandemic in 10 years instead of 100 years. And I hope I just didn't jinx us with that. So that's how I get that comment, I suppose.
We will all knock on wood. Graham Briggs is the state epidemiologist with the Illinois Department of Public Health. Dr. Vithya Sundaresan is professor and chief of infectious diseases at the SIU School of Medicine in Springfield. And Jonah Meadows is the North Shore editor for the news site Patch. Dr. Sundaresan, Jonah, Graham, thank you all so much for being with us today on the 21st show. Thanks to everyone who called in and sent us text messages. We love hearing what you think about what we've been talking about. You can send us an email anytime. talk@21stshow.org is the address. We love reading all of them. We respond to as many as we can. Again, talk@21stshow.org. Let us know what you thought about what we've been talking about. Coming up after a short break, the 300th anniversary of the Illinois National Guard. This is the 21st show. Stay with us.